I'm Christopher Lydon with Duke Ellington's new biographer, Harvey G. Cohen, at King's College in London.
Hello, and welcome to a red letter day in the story of jazz. All this great audience, and incidentally a lot of the profession around, as far as I can see, all here to do honour to the greatest man in the story of jazz. Ladies and gentlemen, we present Mr. Duke Ellington.
From a cultural historian who has been to the bottom of the Smithsonian's oceanic archive on Duke Ellington, this is the story of all the things that it took, besides musical genius, to make Duke Ellington forever the presiding figure in jazz. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Harvey Cohen, with Duke Ellington's America, you make it a great long season for jazz biographies. After Robin Kelly's Thelonious Monk and Terry Teachout's Louis Armstrong, Duke comes out in your story, Harvey Cohen, and in the music, as a race man, an identity builder with a very subtle sense of who my people, as he used to say, really were. He comes through as a strategic businessman who learned from the people who used him and liberated himself. He comes through as a commercial artist whose soul survived show business, which almost never happens. Where do you start? Under all the tunes we'll get to hear, the story of the man and his country in the first 75 years of the 20th century.
I guess where I would start is this is a book that examines Duke Ellington as a figure in American history, not just in American music. Looking at these files at the Smithsonian, there was just a lot larger tale there to tell that needed a historian to tell it. And it was a tale that showed how influential Ellington was in American life and American history, especially looking at themes like civil rights and race, business, marketing, all the work he did for the U.S. government, religion, and a bunch of other subjects that I hope we'll hit today. And also, Christopher, if you're talking about the start, I think it's very important to note where Duke Ellington grew up. And that was in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. And at that time, that was, at least comparatively, the best place in the United States to be if you're an African-American at this time of discrimination and Jim Crow and segregation and so forth.
His father was a butler, had worked in Grover Cleveland's White House from time to time. His mother, as I remember, was the daughter of a policeman, one of a couple of dozen on the Washington force. But these people had confidence, they had assurance, they had manners, even before the 20th century.
And, Ellington learned how to conduct himself through the example of his parents, through the example of other adults in the Washington, D.C. black community. And one of the important things he picked up was that as an African-American, you were supposed to command respect for the race, not demand respect for the race, as African-Americans often did after World War II during the Civil Rights era. And so Ellington came up in kind of a different time period in terms of black history, and the kinds of attitudes that he held showed that.
I'd like to play Black and Tan Fantasy, one of those early 20s hits by the Duke Ellington Orchestra, in New York. Right there is a change of the locus of the emerging black culture. But talk about that early so-called jungle music, Harvey.
Well, it's not a term that the Ellington Band would have used. In my book, the drummer Sonny Greer, Ellington's childhood friend and the drummer in the band, he credited actually George Gershwin with coming up to that, with that term. But he said the Gershwin didn't like to use it in front of the guys. He thought it might insult them. In any case, it became a big commercial trademark of the band. But not for long, only during the initial Cotton Club engagement of 1927 to 1931. And if you listen to the recordings of this period, you see that really these recordings were nothing like the jungle. They were nothing like African music. None of the band had studied or perhaps even heard African music. This was really sophisticated music, coming from the streets of New York City and Washington, D.C.
It was also jungle music with a social agenda. I mean, in the 20s, Duke Ellington was writing about composing a record of the Negro experience in this country. It was a big canvas, he said himself.
Absolutely. Throughout his life, from the 20s to the 70s, he was dedicated to the cause of creating a body of, as he would call it in the 20s and 30s and 40s, Negro music, you know, later on black music or African-American music. And he was quite committed to this.
Harry Cohen, place him in the Harlem Renaissance, as they called it.
Well, if you look at the studies and the books about the Harlem Renaissance today, they always mention these important black musicians of the 20s like Mr. Ellington and Mr. Armstrong and Fletcher Henderson and so forth. But if you really go back to those days, these same Negro intellectuals, as they were called then, that were the ones in the vanguard of the Harlem Renaissance, they mostly had no use for these musicians, with the possible exception, actually with the definite exception of Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, who had, I think, a firmer grip on what was really going on in African-American culture at the time. And if you look at some of the writings of people like W.B. Du Bois and Alan Locke, you know, their point of view was that if these jazz and blues artists wanted to really make an impression and really score a point for high culture and the cause of the African-American struggle, they should really take their jazz and blues musical themes and somehow transform them into classical music, and this is what was needed. They obviously didn't really understand what was going on. They were going for a high culture perspective. They didn't think jazz and blues belonged to it in the 1920s, but of course, that's how we feel about that music today.
It's so interesting because it's precisely what Duke Ellington did and said he was going to do, to tell the story of his people in their own vernacular forms.
Ellington was so much more successful than the Harlem Renaissance intellectuals and writers at doing this, at getting it across, at getting people to listen to him, at making a living. I mean, today we study all these Harlem Renaissance writers. I've taught courses about it. I love these writers, but none of them really made money. You know, I mean, Langston Hughes wasn't making a regular living from his artistry until the 1950s, the 1960s, whereas Ellington was getting his message out and making a lot of money in the 1920s and 1930s, and especially in the 1930s, not a lot of people were in the Great Depression, were they black or white.
Not even Ralph Ellison in the end. And Ralph Ellison started out as a musician, great admirer of Duke Ellington, but Invisible Man does not resound in American life the way Duke Ellington's music does.
And of course, that comes out in the early 1950s. That's even later than what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Duke Ellington's proposal for his own work always reminds me of the line in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, in which Stephen Dedalus says, "I go to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race." Duke says virtually the same words.
The jazz musician Dizzy Gillespie said on more than one occasion, you know, that Duke Ellington is a historian. And I think that's one of the many roles that Ellington, you know, took on for himself. And because he worked in the field of music and not in the field of history books like myself and other scholars do, a lot of people discounted that. And one of the many things I'm trying to do in the book is show that how attuned Duke Ellington was to these issues of history, and not just African-American history, but all of American history.
Could we play Duke's composition, Harlem, some of which he narrates himself? It's a perfect instance, I think, of what you're talking about.
Sure.
So now, Harlem, or rather our tone parallel to Harlem. Harlem, of course, being a place that we've lived very close to and with and have absorbed many of the qualities and quantities of Harlem. It's a wonderful place. Let's imagine we're starting at 110th Street. We're going up toward 145th Street. These are the north and south extremities of Harlem. We start up through the Latin Quarter, on up into the 125th Street. And we imagine also that we're on Sunday, and we see the people going to church, and it's very peaceful, and there's a girl, well, hip chick, standing on the corner. She stops the traffic. Then we imagine a funeral. And, you know, it's a general atmosphere of every other place in the world. Some happy people, some are blue, some are pretty well off, and some are not too well off. And if you watch closely, you may see us in our civil rights demands as we pound away. The opening statement in Harlem is Cootie Williams as he pronounces the word Harlem.
Thank you.
I think, you know, when I hear Ellington speak about his composition Harlem, and I think it is one of his greatest pieces, particularly one of his greatest longer pieces, I guess I think about all the discrimination and segregation that Ellington saw. And, you know, one of the things that Ellington fought against was how limited the vision of an African-American was in American life when he was coming up. And he fought against that his whole career. You know, he was always trying to expand how people viewed African-Americans in their culture. And that's one of the reasons why he composed in so many genres, you know. He loved the hot and torrid and danceable hit singles. But he also made sure he did plenty of ballads. He did plenty of extended pieces. He tried to show that there was no area of artistic endeavor, you know, that couldn't be transformed into what he used to call Negro music.
Harvey Cohen introduced this very controversial figure of Irving Mills, a song plugger whom Ellington engaged to manage and market him. A difficult marriage, but an interesting one. What was the problem, and who won in the end?
They both won, really. And I don't think it was – I mean, at times it was a difficult musical marriage, but I think they both made it work for each of them, and each of them benefited hugely from it. So to go back to the beginning here, Irving Mills was a second-generation immigrant, a Jewish immigrant. He grew up on the Lower East Side of New York City. By the 1910s, he was engaged with his older brother Jack in a music publishing business called Mills Music eventually. And it was Irving Mills who, sometime in the mid-20s, probably 1925, 1926, saw Ellington for the first time in New York City at a club called the Kentucky Club. And you got to give Irving Mills a lot of credit, even though, you know, we're going to criticize him as well here. Because Irving Mills was the guy out of all the music business professionals in New York City that was able to visualize the potential of Duke Ellington, that he was not only going to be a great performer, but a great composer, and a great composer who could appeal really to anyone in the world. Well, Irving Mills realized that Ellington's talent was so diverse and so promising that Ellington would be able to cross over to a wide audience as well. And when Irving Mills was interviewed, and when his sons were interviewed, and they were the ones who continued on the business after Irving left it, they all said that this wasn't done because of some sort of idea of racial equality or something like that. It was done on a purely business basis. Irving Mills didn't want to just sell Duke Ellington music to the 10% of America that was black. He wanted to sell the music to 100% of Americans, no matter their color. And he ended up being, you know, absolutely right on this.
We know there was a certain open fraud in calling these songs the work of Ellington and Mills. The copyright and the residual benefits go to Mills's family as well as Ellington's. At the same time, he did conceive a kind of royal figure. He marketed a sort of genius, and he was tuned to this whole question of class, elegance, dignity, that had to serve Duke Ellington very, very well over the years. I mean, he'd been dubbed Duke in high school long before he ever met Irving Mills. On the other hand, he made it a brand, and it was hugely valuable to Duke.
Yeah, you know, and that brand was, of course, not just hype. It was based on the substance of Ellington and where he was from. And in the book, I argue that Ellington had a major input into this marketing as well. I mean, to take the subject that you first brought up, this issue of compositions, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of Ellington compositions that have Irving Mills' name on it. From many witnesses of the time, it seems like Irving probably did not write a thing or wrote very little, maybe wrote a title here or there, perhaps edited lyrics or something like that. It looks like most of the credits that Irving Mills has on Ellington songs are not deserved. But we have to put it in the context of the time. This was the way the music business ran in these days. And Ellington was comfortable with that. Ellington never complained about Irving Mills publicly. Instead, he credited him for setting up this great career that Ellington had for about a half a century.
Speaking of sharing and animosity and rivalry, there's a huge subject, and you probably know all about it, involving credit, involving who were the sources of Ellington's tunes. I've read that Barney Bigard claimed to have written Mood Indigo as a little warm-up exercise of his own, and of course Duke appropriated it, became one of his most famous tunes. Johnny Hodges probably wrote that wonderful tune, the blues tune, Things Ain't What They Used to Be. I've heard that he lost the credit for that in a card game to Mercer Ellington. But the biggest question of all arises when Billy Strayhorn joins the band at the end of the 1930s. He has already written what becomes the Ellington theme song, Take the A-Train. He's written Lush Life. But from then on, it's never entirely clear what Duke Ellington wrote and what Billy Strayhorn wrote. Would you take that relationship apart?
I think there's a lot of new information about Billy Strayhorn in my book. He was, of course, Ellington's close friend, his writing partner. He comes to the band in the late 1930s. And he's an enormous, he's an immense influence within the band. You know, he comes in during the swing era. And when you listen to most hit recordings of the swing era, they're often very formulaic. And I think it's very telling about Ellington and about Strayhorn that, you know, Ellington and Strayhorn, they increasingly create these works that fall outside the usual popular music experience, works that have a more adult sensibility. And then you got somebody like Billy Strayhorn, who specializes in these dense kind of musical statements that you don't usually hear on the top 40. You know, he was classically trained to a certain extent. So it's interesting that in the middle of this super commercial era, the most commercial era in American jazz, Ellington brings in this guy who's really far away from all that. And of course, Ellington had his own disputes with the major tenets of the swing era.
It's my pleasure to introduce the eminent composer, orchestrator, Billy Strayhorn. A flat for Billy Strayhorn. Billy Strayhorn, my writing and arranging companion.
Star-Crossed Lovers is a Johnny Hodges alto vehicle written by Strayhorn, actually some years earlier under a different title, but it becomes their version of Romeo and Juliet, and it's a gorgeous piece of music. Shall we listen?
I'm always ready for that track, Christopher.
The Shakespeare suite, Harvey.
Once again, Ellington pointing out that there's no boundaries for African-American music. Here he is, he does this whole suite of songs about William Shakespeare, just like he would later about John Steinbeck. You know, he wasn't limited to just talking about African-American culture. He could talk and write about anything. I believe they called them, you know, it was kind of Shakespeare miniatures. And they are all pretty short pieces. And the programmatic nature of those songs is fairly obscure, but there's some liner notes there with the album where they talk about it. I've seen some pictures where Billy and Duke are writing that piece, and there's, you know, various Shakespeare plays lying around with their spines spread and so forth.
It's always amazing to think how much ground he was covering. Movie music, Anatomy of a Murder, the Far East Suite, with at least touching down in all sorts of exotic places in the world. In your book, you write at length about fighting nostalgia, the idea of not going back, in a sort of, in a vaguely Miles Davis sort of way of mastering one moment and then heading forward. Talk about the Ellington version of that.
Miles Davis got that propensity from Duke Ellington and said so many times. That kind of chameleon-like quality came from Ellington. You never knew what exactly Ellington was going to do next. Maybe it would be a re-recording of his old classics mandated by his record company, but more often than not, it would be some new conceptual piece like the ones you talked about, some of which were influenced by the band's travels around the world under the auspices of the State Department. Maybe it would be a sacred concert. Maybe it would be an album of contemporary songs by people like the Beatles and Wayne Newton, rearranged by Strayhorn for the band. Maybe it would be a piece of African-American culture like the Deep South Suite or Harlem, which we played earlier. You know, and that kind of musical freedom, that ability to leap over the usual musical discrimination that existed in the industry is something that was uniquely Ellingtonian, and it was embraced by jazz and popular performers after Ellington showed the way.
By the end of the 60s and the 70s, Harvey, music had been changed by bebop. Duke seemed to fly right over the changing weather. But the whole racial atmosphere was enormously different after the Civil Rights Movement and to the end of Duke Ellington's life. It was very, very sticky for a man who'd charted the way in so many ways. Take us back to Duke Ellington's experience of the Civil Rights Revolution in the 50s, 60s, 70s.
You know, Ellington had a different perspective than those civil rights activists and the young black audiences of the 50s and 60s. And I think to understand that, we kind of got to go back a little bit in Ellington's career and think about him in terms of being a civil rights leader before the real civil rights period. You know, too often when we see the civil rights revolution portrayed on TV or in books or something, you know, it only gets defined in terms of marches, speeches, protests. And what I point out in the book is that in this time of Jim Crow, in this time of segregation, when it was dangerous to speak out, you know, Ellington, through that image that Mills and he created, subverted and undercut racial stereotypes, created new images for blacks in the mass media. Ellington's method, learned in Washington, D.C., was infiltration, not confrontation. So I think you can see why, you know, Ellington of this older generation sometimes did have some conflicts with this newer post-war civil rights generation. And you can see that beginning especially in the early 1950s when a black newspaper misquoted Ellington as saying that blacks, quote, ain't ready yet for racial integration. This set off just a torrent of criticism against Ellington in the 1950s, and it really set back his reputation for several years in the black community, and he didn't start retrieving it until his achievements were once again unearthed and re-examined in the late 50s and the early 60s. He eventually got the highest award possible from the NAACP. It's called the Spingarn Award. And, of course, in 1963, in the midst of some of the worst civil rights violence in American history, he does his show called My People in Chicago. And it's a summer-long show with the band that highlights, you know, once again, African-American history, especially directed towards black children who Ellington feared weren't getting information about African-American history and achievement in schools the way that he did when he was a kid in Washington, D.C.
In the 1940s, Harvey Cohen, Duke Ellington wrote and performed at Carnegie Hall his Black, Brown, and Beige Suite. It was never quite ready for that first performance, and then he didn't persist in playing it or perfecting it. It sort of sticks there in a kind of unresolved way. I learned a whole lot more about it in your book, including the text that he wrote for it. Tell the story of Black, Brown, and Beige.
Well, Black, Brown, and Beige originally started as, I guess, some kind of a folk opera that Ellington started working on in the early 1930s, and he talked about it to a few newspapers. At first, it was called Bula, B-O-O-L-A. And Bula was a character in the story who I think represented some sort of an African-American everyman who goes through all of African-American history from the Middle Passage, you know, over the ocean that brought the slaves to America and until their participation in World War II, which is when Black, Brown, and Beige was written and released. And he worked on it intermittently during the 1930s, but then when he was offered his debut at Carnegie Hall in January 1943, he really set upon working on it in the couple months before that. And along with the music, he also wrote this 40-page scenario in prose and in verse, in poetry, about what black history the 45-minute piece was actually illustrating. And it's a really fascinating document because it's Ellington's vision of black history and also his place within it. And if you look at this document, first of all, it's very emotionally moving, and I include a lot of it in the book thanks to the Ellington Estate, who was very generous in approving my use of that work. And what you find is that Ellington was quite well versed about black history, more so than the historians in the profession of the day. You know, he's talking about, you know, figures and concepts about African American history that were very controversial and not accepted in the 1940s, but today are accepted parts of the historiography of black people in America. For example, he talks about the heroism of the slave rebellions, the heroism of people like Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman. And as I said, you know, today they're accepted bits of African American history. But back then, if this scenario would have been released, which it wasn't, it would have been really controversial. And I think this is perhaps one of the reasons why Ellington never released this document in his lifetime. And it only came to light when the Smithsonian acquired his business and personal papers in the late 80s. I'll read you an excerpt that includes this idea of paternalism. And it's labeled 1700. That's the year in which it takes place. And here's Ellington writing from the scenario for Black, Brown, and Beige. Bula put down his heavy load and gazed about. He'd been looking at this tree-swept land, reclaimed by steady swinging of his ringing axe, and was proud of what he saw there. Honest toil was not without reward. Had not this toil restored those steely muscles rippling neath the black satin smoothness of his skin? Had not the sun erased the mark of cruel, cold hate that etched his face the night they brought him to this strange and friendless place? Work, work, work. Work. But to work was to grow strong, and he knew weak men could not survive this test of worthiness to be free. Bula sang while he worked. Bula danced away from a boot in the breeches. A song eased his master's conscience. Bula reasoned, I'll sing and hide my thoughts from him. A silent slave was a brooding slave. A brooding slave was a dangerous slave. Too many masters found dead or not at all. So sing, you black bastards, sing. A song eased the lash. The whip fell less frequently across his weary back. Bula sang. His master smiled. His slaves were happy. He complimented himself on his great philanthropy. And if you look at some of those old documents from the slave masters of the time of slavery in the United States, you know, you find sentiments like that where you know, the slaveholders were thinking they were doing so much good for these African Americans and they understood them so well. And the documents unearthed since then have shown that that wasn't the case at all.
There's so many instances of Duke's writing that are extraordinarily good and powerful and clear. Why didn't he incorporate that text, you suppose, in a definitive recording of Black, Brown, and Beige?
For one thing, a lot of these sentiments, a lot of the African-American history expressed would have been too controversial for audiences of the time. And Ellington wanted to keep composing, wanted to keep reaching out to people. He didn't want to close any doors. So I think he might have been scared of that. But I think the main reason was that the 45-minute Black, Brown, and Beige piece at Carnegie Hall got almost a uniformly negative reaction. And I think the critics of the time, especially the jazz and pop critics of the time, they weren't ready for a 45-minute piece. And it's a very complex piece whose charms are unearthed after many listens. It's a piece that rewards concentrated, repeated listening. And, you know, a bunch of critics in Carnegie Hall expecting a swinging jazz band, I don't think they were ready to comprehend that. And when you read the reviews, you really do get that impression. And I think Ellington... was affected by that, unfortunately. He tried not to usually let criticism affect him, but he really never performed the entire Black, Brown, and Beige piece again. He never recorded it in a studio in its entirety. I think he was affected by that criticism.
Mm. The song that sounds like a spiritual, Come Sunday, has survived wonderfully. What's your favorite part of that Black, Brown, and Beige? Maybe we should play a little of it.
You know, one of the really great Ellington pieces of all time is when he recorded Come Sunday with Mahalia Jackson.
Yes.
Lord, dear Lord of love, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my Lord, dear Lord of love, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my
Harvey Cohen, sum up the gifts of this man, if you will. And as you say, they go beyond music. I always think of Albert Murray, who was a friend of Duke Ellington's, wonderful writer. I love especially his book, Stompin' the Blues.
Me too.
Yeah, and he writes, those who regard Ellington as the most representative American composer have good reason. Not unlike Emerson, Melville, Whitman, Twain, Hemingway, and Faulkner in literature, he quite obviously has converted more of the actual texture and vitality of American life into first-rate, universally appealing music than anybody else. That always formed my view. What's your distillation of kind of why we're talking about Duke Ellington, and we'll talk about him forever?
What I found when I was looking back at the period and the context of Ellington's music was that he accomplished really even more than what Albert Murray was arguing. I mean, if you look at what was going on in American culture as a whole when Ellington started his career, I think you can see some of the real significance of what Ellington did. Before World War II, here in the United States, if you were teaching in a college, as I do, it was dangerous to your career to teach courses about American art, American music, American literature, and because it was not held up as anything respectable. Everybody knew at that time that European culture was, you know, the kind of culture that everybody should aspire to, and American culture, especially African-American culture, was second-rate or worse. Right, you're endangering your career if you try to teach about these things. And what I argue in the book, and I show a lot of evidence for it, is that Ellington was a primary influence in getting Americans to accept their own art as something serious and lasting. And he did this in a lot of ways. For one thing, he did this by playing his music on the radio at the Cotton Club, which really changed the definition of African-American music. It didn't have to be just dancing, sexy music anymore. You know, he did a lot of ballads, did a lot of Broadway stuff, did a lot of programmatic material, did extended pieces, you know, really expanded what Americans expected from African-Americans. Also, when Ellington went on tour for the first time after the Cotton Club, he toured on a circuit called the Publix Theater Circuit. Not very well known now, but Ellington looked back in his autobiography 40 years later at this circuit as an important step in Ellington's orchestra combating musical discrimination. And this was because this was a theater circuit. People were listening to the Ellington Orchestra, this African-American musical congregation, while sitting down, like in a theater. And he was playing music for people seated, like they would be at a classical concert. To us today, this is not as striking. But back in the day, in the context of the 1930s, it was huge. Even more importantly, in 1933, Ellington and the band make a European tour for the first time. They especially spend their time in the UK, where I reside right now. And the critics in the UK, they accepted Ellington as the genius and composer that Mills was selling him as a lot quicker and a lot more enthusiastically than Americans did. And there was all kinds of reviewers in the UK looking at these shows and comparing Ellington to people like Stravinsky and Beethoven and all these kinds of classical comparisons. And some of these comparisons were pretty clumsy. But their willingness to view Ellington in the company of those composers, which is pretty common today, it was really radical back then, and Irving Mills, the smart marketing guy that he was, he took these reviews and he syndicated them all over the United States. And it got Americans talking about their own music, as I was saying, as something serious and lasting. And to talk about Ellington's music, African-American music in the same way, was really quite shocking. And I found headlines even in Texas on tours the Ellington made in the South after the 1933 European tour, where newspapers in Texas are talking about Ellington's piano art and talking about him as a great composer. And that's a real contrast to what you would usually see in the American media about black artists. And Ellington makes American music into something more respectable long before the artists who usually get the credit for this achievement. You know, you look at somebody like Aaron Copland, his major pieces like Appalachian Spring and so forth, they were principally got known about the time of World War II. The same thing with Charles Ives. Here was Ellington about a decade before already making these inroads, already, you know, changing the American conception of what, you know, serious music and art was in the United States.
I think his partner there, Billy Strayhorn, nailed it. And you quoted early in the book, Harvey Cohen, where they're talking in 1964, 10 years before Duke died, about a movie or an epic story of the Ellington career. The writer wants to make it about race. And Strayhorn says, no, I don't think it should be racial because I don't think he's racial. And he goes on to say it's about taking a high position and then holding it in an incredibly competitive commercial art world for the rest of his life. And he says he established a certain position, which wasn't easy to get to either, but he had to struggle to get there, hold it, and it's still harder. It's still a struggle to keep people from making you bow down, to playing what they want you to do. And Duke did it his way to the end.
You know, that quote you said, it's one of the reasons why I put that in the front of the books. I think it just really talks about the Ellington story. It's one thing to be a one-hit wonder in pop music, but to sustain this career of constant development, to keep on pushing your own envelope of creativity. Ellington in the 50s and 60s, which is when Strayhorn made that quote, Ellington was in the process of fighting nostalgia. I mean, sure, he would still play the old singles live and make the fans happy, but always at every show, he would play some sort of new composition that didn't sound anything like what he'd played at the Cotton Club in the 20s or during the swing era in the 1930s. You know, the way I like to look at it is that, you know, compare Ellington to his peers at the time in the 1960s. You know, somebody like a Bing Crosby or a Louis Armstrong, both enormously important and engaging musical figures in American history. And in the 1960s, they were probably drawing more crowds and more money than Ellington was on the road. But you look at what they were doing, they were pretty much performing the same kind of music that they were performing 30, 35 years earlier in the 1930s. Whereas Ellington, at least on his albums, was almost always, you know, pushing ahead, collaborating with young jazz lions like Coltrane and Mingus, when all the other big band competition had faded away at the end of World War II. You know, he was still out in front, still experimenting, still doing new things. And, you know, you listen to his stuff from the mid-60s, the late-60s, and usually it bears very little resemblance to what went on before. And as Billy Strayhorn says in my introduction to the book, as you quoted, that was a really tough thing to do, to be able to sustain a career over that time, to be able to do music the way you want. And, you know, it provided a model for other people in pop music. You know, you talked about Miles Davis. Of course, Bob Dylan in his autobiography also cites Duke Ellington as a huge influence in that. So, you know, the influence is not just in American history or African-American history, it's also in cultural history, in music history, in providing this American example of artistic endeavor and what it entails.
You remind me of that wonderful Money Jungle recording he made with Charles Mingus, but it's also his most monkish Duke piano. He's playing with Max Roach on drums, and maybe we ought to go out on one of those Money Jungle blues as just a token of how young, how modern, how forward Duke remained till the very end.
He redefined what it was to be a senior citizen in pop music.
He's an inspiration to all of us. Harvey Cohen, this has been huge fun. Thank you for this book, the work of many, many years. And it's a wonderful read, 600 and some pages. I loved it all. Thank you for joining us very generously with this conversation too, Harvey.
And thank you so much, Christopher.
Paul McCarthy, Ben Mandelkern, and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation with Harvey Cohen. His book is Duke Ellington's America. He teaches at the Center for Cultural Media and Creative Industries Research at King's College in London. Our conversation isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.